Thank you very much for coming out on a hazy, rather early morning, all the way out to the Sheraton. We appreciate the effort you made. If you rolled down from your hotel room, the appreciation is still there. It's nice to see that we have a few date enthusiasts in the audience. So my name's Tyler Bell. I've got Pete Warden and Drew Vogel to my left. Pete is a his career guidance counselor suggested he become a brewer. instead, he ended up working for Apple. And amongst other things, he, after leaving their employ, he outraged them terribly by uncovering that the fact that they were actually logging where people go and where the phones go as well. Pete's now the CTO of Jetpack, which is a large-scale data company focusing on the travel industry, and Pete will be telling us a lot about geo today and images and big data. To my far left is Drew Vogel. I'm delighted to have Drew here today. Drew comes from the Sunlight Foundation, which is dedicated towards improving government transparency and visibility into government activities. And this is entirely a data-driven exercise. So Drew will be talking a little bit about his endeavors on that front. And the way we've laid it out today is one of the things about panels that we found, certainly generally, but specifically at South by Southwest, is that people come up, they talk a little bit, and you don't hear details or specifics about what they do. And so I wanted to try to obviate that concern by having each of the panelists walk through a little bit of the specifics of the kinds of things that they deal with on a day-to-day basis, both at a high level within their sector, but also within their business itself. So that'll sort of take the form of about three sort of short 10-minute presentations, I'll kick things off. Does that sound good to everyone? Great. So my sort of mini talk really focuses on the role that humans play within the disambiguation process. Generally, I should say before we kick in here that this is tagged as an intermediate panel within the South by presentation. So we're working on a lot of assumptions that people know what entities are, dealing with disambiguation, entity resolution. If these terms are funny, by all means raise your hand and give me a shout. It is a funny term? Okay, I'll be sure to introduce some context. Thank you. So when we're dealing with entities, first of all, you've heard of the Internet of Things. That's sort of a term that's permeated the meme sphere. This is not about the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is about how to connect your refrigerator to the Internet so it can order you milk at the appropriate time. This panel is, in fact, so if that's what you're here for, please don't leave. It's nice to have the headcount. and I think you'll find this much more interesting. Anyhow, the Internet of Entities is a moniker that we are using to describe the idea that the Internet as it exists today is wholly, if not solely, keyword-based. So it's all based around strings rather than well-defined things. And generally, you could describe these at a very high level as people, places, and things. And so people and places and things are described by their attributes, by their names, by their email addresses, but very rarely are they defined unequivocally, that is, without ambiguity and with very, very clear definition. And I blame this state of affairs on search, because search is always based around keywords. It's not based around identifiers. Search is designed for human beings. It's not designed for machines. So the problem with search is that whenever you get a series of blue links like this, human interaction is always required. And so you have to deal with these pesky human beings, which are always required to say, this is your intention, this is what you were looking for, whether it's a person, place, or thing, or a business, or a geography. An individual human is always required to click on a link and say, this is actually the one that I meant. And that's fine. That's the sort of Google way of things, and it's done well for them, and the Internet's done well by Google, certainly. But one of the larger issues that we're facing now is that the way that we think, the way that our products are designed, the way that our APIs are implemented, human disambiguation is always required. So right now, this is where we stand, which is the apogee of machines and humans. And really, what we're going to be talking about today is what can we do to better improve the way that machines communicate with each other. And we'll be talking a little bit more about, it could be AI. It can be focused on things like Siri. Could be talking about no matter how much computational power you throw at a problem, if there is not an underlying knowledge base, it will be extremely hard to advance our human progress and our technological progress much further. So for the remainder of my introduction, really, I just wanted to focus on the idea. These are just two tweets that I picked up previously. That it's beginning now, probably within the last year or two, from those who are not specialists in the field, to understand that one of the problems on the internet is that everything is siloed. Now, we've heard this before, so that's not an uncommon criticism, but people are beginning to see the solutions as one of two things. Either an unambiguous list of things, so if you have a products database, say, if you have a geo database, being able to resolve entities and strings to those specific identifiers of those databases is being seen as one solution. Another solution is what we generally call concordance or crosswalking, and that idea is that we have one entity that has multiple identifiers across different namespaces, and what you're doing is you're just mapping those different identifiers to a central conceptual entity. So you can think of spokes on a bicycle, where the hub is the entity, and each spoke leads to a different incarnation of that entity. So if we were to take this in the local world, this is a business. It's called The Counter in San Jose, and it has multiple representations online. Now, obviously, this is the way that local data works. It's the way that search works. The data is perpetuated and duplicated across the web. It leads to highly heterogeneous and highly fragmented content. But really, fundamentally, each one of the URLs that are represented by these squares in front of you, these websites, actually describes a physical entity. And this is good because it means the entity is that much more accessible. More specifically, this is bad because there's no means by which one can resolve all of these different URLs to the same place. So what we're going to be talking about later today is in part the idea of a minimum viable record, that is to say an entity that can be described by its minimum number of attributes, and also the idea of identifiers. So here what we're seeing now is identifiers. Traditionally, there's something like a 32-bit integer. Increasingly, there are URIs and even URLs. So web pages, URLs themselves are being used as unambiguous identifiers across the internet. And I wanted to introduce also for basically as a segue into Peter's talk, the idea of microformatting. So one of the great things about microformatting is that you have machine-readable content that underlies a web page. And it's taken off massively. You can see that within the graph, 2008 is indicated by the light blue, 2009 by the orange, and then dark blue. And you can see that we have a lot of RDFA taking off. H-card has gone down, which I find to be very curious. But what you don't see on here is OG, Facebook's OG markup. So I'm shooting out a lot of acronyms and a lot of terminologies very quickly. I appreciate that, and I'm going to sort of back away from the conch now. I did want to just highlight that the propensity of markup behind sites like Yelp. This is what the human sees, of course, but this is what the machine sees. And this is interesting because Yelp, at least when I pulled this screen grab, Yelp was doing two kinds of attribute markup. They were using both OG as well as H-card. So this kind of content, these kind of attributes are machine-readable. It's fantastic, but what we don't get is specific unique identifiers there. But the actual web page URL helps. So there's a lot more to talk about. I've done enough of an overview, enough of an introduction. I'm keen now to hand the microphone over to Pete Warden from Jetpack. Thanks, Pete.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Tyler. Can everybody hear me? Cool. No. Oh, that's better. Awesome. So, I'm Pete Warden. I'm CTO at Jetpack. And I'm a bit odd when it comes to this sort of entity stuff on the web, because I actually realized that I kind of like the web weird and messy and chaotic. And I'm worried that by pushing too hard on publishers to be adding stuff, we're going to go down the same sort of rabbit hole that we went with sort of the semantic web, where unless people have a strong motivation on the publisher side to actually put stuff in, so some examples of that are if they want to increase their search result presence, or if they want to have better appearance on Facebook when people are sharing links, those are practical reasons to add tagging. But most of the failure of the semantic web was down to the fact that there were no strong benefits to the publishers, and we kind of expected the publishers to go ahead and create all of this content for us, and then as developers we would kind of reap the benefits and do cool stuff with it. So I'm actually going to talk about a couple of the practical applications that I've been doing around location, and why the kind of the messy, ambiguous, chaotic, unstructured approach actually has some advantages, like why it's useful, and really why ambiguity is not a piece of noise that's being introduced into the web. It's actually really at the heart of the way that we describe stuff on the web. So a lot of what I've been doing over the last few years has been dealing with freeform text that's describing locations. So this is the Twitter location field that everybody fills out when they fill out their Twitter profile. And here it actually looks kind of nice and clean and fairly well formed, but you can put anything you want in that box. So if you, you get sort of, things from everywhere to sort of yo mamas. And even when people are putting sensible stuff in, for example, here's Georgia. Now, to us in context, that looks fairly unambiguous, but of course it's also the name of a country. So there's a pretty deep problem trying to cope with this text field and turn it into something useful. There's a lot of work you have to do to take that string and actually figure out where it's actually talking about. And there's a lot of messy logic, a lot of special cases, a lot of, if you see sort of Jordan, it's unlikely to be the name of the country. If it's in an American context, it's much more likely to be the name of a person, and sort of all of that sort of stuff that makes this a massive pain to deal with. And I've had to spend a lot of time taking these strings and turning them into things that I can use on a map. Now, the alternative approach is Facebook's approach, where they actually constrain you to a limited whitelist of places that you can put in. And as a developer, what that means is they give you latitude, longitude positions for each place. So they have very unambiguous, very, very clear entities that they hand over to you. And you'd think, oh, as a developer, I would actually be happy about that. And in some ways I am, but what you lose by forcing people into that straitjacket of a whitelist is, for example, a lot of people on Twitter use neighborhood names to describe where they are. Those are really, really interesting because neighborhood names are pure folksonomies. Like, there's no official register, there's no official boundaries for where most neighborhoods are. So if you want to actually look at where, like, how neighborhoods are changing and like what neighborhoods people think there are in a city, you can't do that in a whitelisted, unambiguous system. You have to have some sort of freeform text entry to be able to do that. And you also miss out on people are using this location field to kind of express something that isn't just kind of, you know, mechanical and computable. They're talking about, hey, I'm bicoastal, or, you know, I'm in flyover country, or, you know, there's lots and lots of very hard to capture things that are going into that location field that turn out to be very important and very interesting. So on a small scale, that's kind of the difference between the web we have today, where we're defining everything as this really hard to deal with but very expressive freeform text, versus actually having very unambiguous, very clear, very non-redundant entities defined in the web pages we're creating. This is kind of the Facebook approach, and this is really what we would have to ask of creators, like the people who are creating web pages, assuming that this isn't just a mirror of a database somewhere, assuming that most of this stuff is actually human generated, we would have to have tools that helped creators kind of pick the entities that we hoped they meant. So we would have a whole extra sort of, you know, we have to deal with the fact that people don't necessarily know which entities they're talking about. You know, and the thing I want to be clear about here as well is I'm not against sort of, I love the fact that, you know, I use unambiguous entities all the time in my internal work. Like, that's what I have to convert things into in order to be able to compute on them. You know, that's kind of what computers can understand. I don't think we can ever really get them as a general purpose thing in the wild. I think most of the content out on the web is going to continue to be this kind of this sea of stuff that's generated for humans, and we're going to get occasional islands of kind of unambiguous well-tagged content, but for the foreseeable future, we're basically going to have to be dealing with the chaos. And so, you know, sort of Robocop and a unicorn, I would love to see more unambiguous entities coming through and, like, the tagging stuff actually working. And I'm going to keep working on, actually, my own projects where I'm actually trying to take freeform text and turn it into something unambiguous so that people can be helped to do much better tagging. And I love, you know, the work that the community is doing here. I just think we need to face the fact that it's not a problem that we are going to be able to solve in any foreseeable future by persuading publishers to change the way that they create their content. I think it's going to be much more of a battle of creating smarter algorithms, doing better engineering, to kind of take stuff that has been produced aimed at humans and figuring out, you know, humans can look at a web page and figure out an unambiguous entity from the context and from the attributes. Our problem is that our machines aren't smart enough to be able to take that same information and do the same thing. So I'm pretty much wrapped up. It's kind of my rant. And I was going to pass it over to Drew for...
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is that good? All right. So the topic that we're here to discuss is the Internet of Entities, and the fun, sort of sexy word is entities. That's the one that people are least familiar with. But I wanted to just talk about the internet word, precisely because we're all more familiar with it. The internet or internet work of has been so successful largely because of network effects. So we all know what network effects are, even if you don't know the term. The network effects were most famously described by the founder of 3Com, who said that the power of a communications network, in his case a fax machine, is the number of users squared. That's probably mathematically not very precise, but the general principle is right. And we see this today as everybody uses Facebook because everybody else uses Facebook. They were the first of the critical mass of users that now it's a self-perpetuating theme. I'm part of the generation that has lived every day of my adult life with the commercialized, widely available internet. I've fully internalized the power of network effects for my personal communications, and I think pretty much everybody at South By probably has as well. We're now beginning to realize the power of network effects for data, though. Just like the power of a communications network is amplified by the number of users, so too the power of, or the value of each data is amplified by the number of other pieces of data that it can be compared with or combined with, in other words, linked to. And as we develop an internet of entities, whatever specific form that takes, the bedrock foundation will be on identifiers. So we're going to have to get that right before we can get to any sort of semantic web promised land or anything like that. Unfortunately, we just seem to be really bad at it. We have a really bad track record of developing unique identifiers. One of the problems with that is that entities just simply have multiple identities. One vexing problem that took me about an afternoon to pull all the pieces apart is, who is Saxby Chambliss? So at the Sunlight Foundation, we work with a lot of election data, and Saxby Chambliss is, he's been a member of Congress for a long time, and he has a couple of different identities if you're working in this space. He's a member of Congress, and as such, the Congressional Biographical Directory has given him something called a BioGuide ID that starts with C00. Before he was a member of Congress, he had to run for his current Senate seat, and so the FEC gave him an ID, starts with S2. Before that, he ran for a House seat. That ID starts with H2, and throughout all of this time, he's received campaign donations, and the Center for Responsive Politics, who does a lot of great work in campaign finance, gave him an ID that starts with N00. All of these IDs are why they all relate to Saxby Chambliss. Are all perfect for their own use, but if you try to misuse them, you'll end up with bad results. And so the question, or the answer to the question, who is Saxby Chambliss, is, well, it depends why you're asking. In other words, the identity of something is use-dependent or context-dependent. And this gets so much more complicated when you try to answer the question, what is a corporation, or what is a given corporation, like, say, GE? So a corporation can be any of these items, a taxable entity, an employer, a creditor, a borrower. They can enter into all sorts of contracts, including derivatives, which we saw in the 2008 financial crisis. And thanks to Citizens United decision, they can also now be a direct political donor. There's tons more examples that you could give, but they all boil down to it's a legal construct. And so when you're talking about something like a corporation, now not only is their identity use-dependent, it's now also dependent on where you're asking the question from and from where the corporation is from. Next slide. So the government has a lot of money that they spend on procurement and on grants that they give out in order to develop some sort of social goal. And they try to keep track of recipients of grants or contracts through something called a DUNS number. This is a great example. It's a cautionary tale of why you need to know what your identifiers were meant for and how not to misappropriate them. The DUNS stands for Data Universal Numbering System. It was created by a company called Dun & Bradstreet somewhere in the 60s for their credit reporting service. It works great for their credit reporting service, and I'm sure that as they do this today, it still works great for them. Unfortunately, their government decided to misappropriate it about a decade or so ago, and it's not fared as well in those realms. So the Sunlight Foundation, a couple of months ago, put together a tool to help you explore why it's so hard to answer the question, who is General Electric? There's a website called 6 Degrees of Corporations. If you Google for it, I encourage you, if you have a device open, do it now and let everybody hear your oohs and ahs, because it'll look much better on your screen than it does in the slides. The website has quite a few resources that explain why it's such a difficult problem and sort of can point you in the direction of people who are trying to solve the problem. There's a tool that allows you to search for a company. It searches the government spending databases and allows you to zoom in and see a structure, a sort of microstructure like this, that if you zoom out, you can then zoom out and see sort of the galaxy of, in this case, General Electric. You can search for many companies. Now, this each dot in that graph, go back, represents a company name, and each line represents a contract, two or more contracts that have a DUNS number and a name on each side of the contract, or of the line. Go for it, too. So a tiny, tiny sliver of the results of that image you saw is that General Electric has contracts or has received grants where they use the name General Electric Company and eight different DUNS numbers. That's not a problem that there's eight DUNS numbers. As the company structure changes, they Dun & Bradstreet will dole out new numbers in order to uniquely represent sort of that snapshot of the company. And it doesn't take much human intuition to know that GE Medical is part of General Electric. But if you look at the far right, there's no way for a computer to know which of those DUNS numbers relates to which other one, because that's private information held only by Dun & Bradstreet, and some areas of the government have it, but they're not able to release it. So while it doesn't take much human intuition to know that GE Medical and General Electric are part of the same sort of galaxy of companies, it takes even less intuition to know that Lockheed Martin and General Electric, two of the biggest government contractors, are not the same company. Yet, if you look in the government spending database and sort of use the if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C sort of principle, that's it doesn't hold in that database. So the closed nature of DUNS makes it really hard to replace at this point. And so while it was used appropriately by Dun & Bradstreet, it was misappropriated by the government, and now all sorts of organizations, Sunlight least among them, has to deal with the results of that decision. So I want to ask you, if you use data, if you link data, just think about the identifiers that are in each data set, understand why those identifiers were created, and question whether or not you're misappropriating them. If you have to develop a new identifier, which may be harder but necessary, please document why you're doing it and how you did it so that people understand both whether or not it's necessary for them to do the same, and also to avoid duplication of work, where as long as if you've done that work and as long as you're open with your identifiers, that will enable the network effects for your data to create, to make that more valuable both for you and the users of the data. If you need some examples of identifiers to sort of give you the guidelines of how to make the proper decisions, any one of these is great. The Center for Responsive Politics is a great example of how to use identifiers in politics and money in politics. But if you're looking to identify an actual Congress member, you should go with the BioGuide ID. It's just looking at the differences between those can be very enlightening. The unique entity number is something developed by Singapore as a way to solve some of these problems within their own country. And there's a case study on the website I mentioned that you can read through in order to get an idea of how successful they've been. Finally, there's an operation out of the UK by a guy named Chris Taggart named Open Corporates that is trying to develop a scraping technology to develop a website that has business registration information for every business on Earth. It's quite a lofty goal, but a worthy one, and definitely worth your attention.
Excellent. Petru, thank you very much. I thought I'd start off with a couple of questions, and then we're happy to certainly to take audience questions as we keep the ball rolling. Pete, you've talked a lot about the geo side, but you haven't told the audience about why you're doing this, and I think it's particularly important to hear the actual sort of pragmatic results of the efforts that you're putting in. Can you tell us a little bit about Jetpack and where entities help and where disambiguation is hurting you the most?
I mean, so what we're doing with Jetpack is basically taking all of the photos that your friends have shared with you on social networks. Like the average Facebook user has over 200,000 photos that their friends have shared with them. And there's no tagging on those. There's no geotagging. There's nothing but the image data and kind of the caption text to help you organize that. And, you know, kind of the names of the albums as just pure text strings. So you've just got this soup of free text. And what we're doing is actually going through that and identifying or trying to identify places that people mention in the captions, you know, both, you know, city and town names, destination names, neighborhood names, bar names, hotel names, restaurant names, and activities, you know, things that people are doing, so that we can give you a travel magazine that's written by your friends, effectively. So it's very similar to kind of the classic web search problem in a lot of ways, which is one reason why my head is so sort of focused on taking kind of a similar approach to dealing with this kind of like soup of text. And it obviously, you know, it has obvious drawbacks. You know, the fact that I mentioned, you know, sort of Jordan is a common kid's name. It's probably not the country if it shows up in a caption. You don't want your friend Chad to show up in Africa. But it's also surprisingly effective. And the I can't see it being nearly as effective if we were relying on people to actually manually tag stuff. And if we were using the geotags that were built into photos, that would actually be a bit of a shock and a surprise to most people. Like, people understand when they caption a photo that they're telling their friends that they were in Hawaii. They don't understand when they upload a photo from their iPhone that it's got their location built in. So that weekend they were supposed to be in Minnesota for a conference and they were actually in Vegas, you know, they don't want that showing up. So, I mean, that shaped a lot of my thinking around this.
Right. One of the unfortunately, we had a fourth panelist, George Oates from the Open Library. She's now at Stamen Design, and she fell ill, unfortunately, so she's not here. But I did want to raise that one of the most important aspects of this initiative towards entities is the actual immediate pragmatic results. So. The semantic web has been criticized, at times heavily criticized, for being a sort of a promised land, was were the words that Pete used. The idea is being that it's somewhere we want to get to one day and just think of all the wondrous things we can do. On the other side of that, certainly being able to articulate unambiguously and without confusion what things are, what people are, in the very near term, give us immediate and practical results. Without having immense amounts of technology or computational power thrown at it. So, Drew, I wanted to ask you about the outcome of the Sunlight Foundation. Specifically, you're looking to increase government transparency. I know that the chairman of the New York Federal Reserve said one of the reasons of the recent financial crash, this is you know, over the last 2-3 years, wasn't that they didn't have the data. They had the data. They knew which transactions were being made, but they could not understand the players in the game because they went by so many different names and so many different faces. Could you talk to the desired outcome of the Sunlight Foundation within that context?
Yeah, sure. That's the quote that you had was accurate. You know, when you file your taxes, when you list out which companies you may own stock in, they don't ask for anything but a company name. You own the stock, you bought it with the ticker symbol, the government has no interest in that. And it's because a company isn't really what you think of as a company often. There's insurance companies, for instance, have a subsidiary for each state in order to both conform with state insurance regulation, also to isolate liability. And these types of structures have arisen for all sorts of reasons, but we're at a place where it's really hard to describe, for instance, which government contractors have the most sort of weight in the graph of contractors. When we were going through the crisis 2008, there was a lot of debate about the whether or not to bail out car companies, and that debate quickly sprawled out into a discussion about AC Delco and other car manufacturers' part suppliers and how that will ripple out. The same is true for when you're trying to analyze sort of the graph of which company owns which company and which company is in a subcontract with another company when it comes to government procurement. There's been a couple of academic papers in that area where they've done a tremendous job of trying to disambiguate things down to the level of being able to report a figure, but the tremendous amount of work that goes into that is something that is really it's hard to replicate because it requires a lot of human disambiguation and simply a lot of computing power in order to go through that cyclically over and over until you reduce the error rates down. And so we would like to be able to show the influence that different players in government have. That's defense contractors. It's also people who donate to campaigns, to be that PACs, super PACs, used to be 527s, or just directly to campaigns. We'd like to be able to show who has the influence, who's got the most push on the levers of power.
Thank you. Pete, you've taken a slightly abject stance by saying that you know things have to be cool, hip, and fruity on the interwebs, and you got to let people do what people are going to do. And I think I would argue as a panelist, although I wouldn't put it as strongly as a moderator, that you're creating a false dichotomy there.
Yeah.
So you spend tons of time figuring out where photos belong to make a good product. Wouldn't you rather have spent that engineering time focusing on the application layer or and basically have that problem solved for you? Has it been worth the aggro? Is the dichotomy between unambiguous entities and then allowing sort of free human input, is there a medium ground? How does that play out in reality?
Yeah, and there definitely is a false dichotomy there. I mean, I had to basically push the advantages of chaos because nobody's really a speaker for the mess. but there's also something very rich and human about the data that I've been able to work with that has given the application a lot more, like it definitely has been a lot harder battle to kind of get the basic information out of it, to get sort of the place information. But because it's this kind of ambiguous, redundant human text that we're dealing with for each photo, I've actually been able to mine that for a lot more useful information than I'd be able to get if I was just looking at a latitude longitude coordinate. So for example, we needed to most photos on Facebook are awful. 70% of the photos that we had humans rate that were taken by their friends were just not inspiring to travel at all. So we had to design an algorithm that could actually identify good photos, like photos that would be inspiring. And what we found was that there was a very high correlation between certain words and certain phrases in the photo captions and actually high-quality photos.
Can you give us some examples?
The number one word that was indicating the worst photos, only less than 3% of photos with the word mommy in them were actually inspiring to travel. And it's not that we hate, it's not that I hate mothers, I really. The UK Mother's Day is coming up on Sunday, so I have to be very careful here. But it's the, those family photos and those photos that had sort of graduation or had, all of these words indicated very personal stuff that really wasn't going to be a good travel photo.
You don't need a Hadoop cluster to figure that out, though, do you?
Well, it actually took the Kaggle. We actually had to contract out and do a data competition to kind of, we could see the correlations, but they were very, very complex. So there were a few that were very clear, like mommy, and also tombs was actually the number one best word. Like over 90% of photos with the word tombs in them were actually awesome. But actually teasing out, there were very, very complex relationships there between all the different words. So teasing them out took a lot of machine learning from a data competition with the Kaggle guys. So there's something very, very rich and very human about having that sort of chaotic, messy, freeform text that people can enter and actually trying to sort of wrestle with it. And you get a much higher error rate, and it is very sort of frustrating as kind of being able to create pure, elegant algorithms. But there's also something that you lose by sort of narrowing how you describe things.
Fair play. You described it perhaps with just a touch of hyperbole as a straitjacket previously. I mean, obviously, what Drew and Sunlight's doing is a very different take, right? There's messiness is not... doesn't reflect on human ingenuity and creativity and the volume of human expression. The messiness actually hides things. It hides transactions. It hides relationships, and it actually obfuscates.
Yeah, and I should be clear. I mean, like, the stuff that Drew's doing is like God's work. You know, it's definitely, you know, I couldn't be more happier at that stuff that's happening there. I just think that, you know, I'd be curious how you think about the deliberate obfuscation that's kind of behind some of the, you know, people don't want necessarily their donations to be found, and how an entity like an ID is resilient, can be resilient to being kind of gamed, you know. I wonder if there's
yeah, there's quite a few ways now in order to hide a donation or a transaction. Some of them are new and some of them are very old. There's, in the political donations landscape, the sort of newest large-scale trick is you have a independent expenditure-only committee that is something that's a construct of the Federal Elections Commission's that is required to disclose all of their donors and all of their the recipients of their expenditures. And they're allowed to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money, but they have to disclose all of that. Now, there's something else called a 501c4. These are, I forget the exact IRS terminology, but they are essentially nonprofits with some sort of social agenda. If you think of, like, the Boys and Girls Club is probably a 501c4, the Urban League, things like this. They take quite a while to set up, and... they do not have to disclose their donors, and they're allowed to spend. Generally, the figure is 50% of their funds on political activities, so long as it's not their main activity. And so, you have 501c4s that are set up so that people can donate large amounts of money to the 501c4. They spend half of that as a political donation to the what's called the super PAC, often the Independent Expenditure Only Committee, and the other half is used for it can be used for a variety of things. If they use it for politics, they can actually go past that 50% threshold. It's just that then those expenses are taxed. So it's a very tax efficient and anonymous way to hide campaign donations, and unfortunately, there's not a whole lot you can do with a machine in order to determine to disambiguate that. It's we rely heavily on laws that push disclosure. To contrast this, the whole landscape of campaign finance has been transformed in the last decade or two decades because of the influence of something that was called soft money. This was money that rich guys could just give unlimited amounts of money to the party, basically, and then the party would dole it out. And it had some tremendously corrupting attributes to it, and so reformers pushed to have that changed, and we're at a situation now where we actually have less disclosure and more money in politics. which is sort of a sad turn of events from my perspective.
You guys better get cracking then.
Yeah, so we have plenty of work ahead of us. But all of this is to say that it relies on people agreeing. So as far as you know, who I am, I have an identity, and whether or not you can describe me accurately depends to a large extent on somebody else corroborating that. And so we all have to sort of agree on what should define things and push for that. In the realm of campaign finance, we just simply need disclosure laws that make people give us a name and a figure as to how much they raised or how much they spent. But it's the same basic problem as creating ontologies in some sort of semantic web, where we'd have to agree on, you know, what attributes are we trying to describe here? And this really pervades all computational endeavors.
So you've heard three very different overviews on a single theme. And the idea here really, of course, was to present a very diverse approach to unambiguous entities. Now, of course, Drew's efforts are not necessarily internet-based. I mean, they are, but it's very much focused on government. And the idea there is to increase transparency and understanding of cash flows and corporate relationships. Within Pete's application, the goal there is to make sure that he gets the most inspiring, beautiful images to you by doing proper geo-disambiguation. And, of course, at Factual, we're focused on creating a global coverage of the world's businesses. The problems that we're all dealing with, of course, are that there are almost countless, but certainly innumerable incarnations of these people, these places, and of course these things, these businesses. And we've taken different approaches to doing the entity disambiguation. I think we'd all acknowledge that the challenge is one that's very suitable and very attractive for engineers, because we see that everybody needs disambiguation. It's a problem that we aren't the only ones that are dealing with. It's certainly a position that has been identified as being just the sort of prime territory for engineering solutions, which is to say, everybody's doing this over and over again. Why don't we just do it once and then share it out? And I think we're all trying to do that in specific ways, and I know some faces in the audience are as well. So we haven't come to any hard conclusions, but what I certainly have hope that we've presented here is an overview, if not an articulation, of the role that distinct, basically named list or entity list can play within various sectors of any kind of basically information-driven business or endeavor. And we're very keen to open the mics up to the audience to hear your questions and comments.
So, thanks for your talk. So, I work for a company, Ranker.com, and we leverage a lot of data from Freebase. And I really liked your analogy of, like, the network effects. And when you have a lot of linked data, it's that much more powerful. So, I guess I was just curious, when we were looking for, like, linked data, we found Freebase to be the best source of that. I'm curious if, you know, if we want to make a disambiguated model of everything in the world, do you think that's perhaps, you know, the way it might happen? I mean, is that the specific solution that might happen, or is some other solution perhaps
Pete, start us off, Pete.
So I actually, one of the things I did was I published a book last year on public data sources through O'Reilly. I'll send, if you contact, don't tell O'Reilly, but if you contact me afterwards, I can send you a PDF if you're really getting deep into that. And, you know, for example, Freebase is, I'm not even really sure how active it is anymore. I mean, it was great for movies and some, you know, some other cultural stuff, but it never seemed to have the momentum that, like, Wikipedia had behind it in terms of, like, constant new additions. DBpedia actually feels like a lot more sustainable project You know, because it's relying on the energy of people contributing to Wikipedia and then kind of doing some work on top of that, kind of free riding on top of that stuff. So, I mean, from my point of view, I'm much more excited about DBpedia as kind of the possible linked data source.
I thought they were kind of, like, a lot of the data in Freebase is sort of the same data.
Well, the nice thing is it can kind of, you know, it can go back and forth, you know, under the open sort of licenses, but the DBpedia stuff is definitely coming, you know, largely coming from Wikipedia and being layered on top of Wikipedia, if that makes sense.
I agree with everything Pete said.
You're a panelist. You're supposed to disagree. You're supposed to disagree.
I just add that the nature of the problem is such that you probably won't ever get to a mapping of everything simply because you can only map everything you know, and there's all sorts of, as much data as we have, new data will come about that invalidates the way you've identified something or categorized something. And so it will be in constant flux. So something like Freebase could be very valuable, but it won't be the panacea.
I tend to take maybe my position's a minority one. I tend to say that there are the difficulty with all the good things about Freebase, and they're acknowledged, and I certainly sign on to that. But the problem is that it requires such heavy manufacturing. So to relate things together, you've got to articulate and manufacture what that thing is. You can't just sort of add in a bunch of strings or bang in a bunch of attributes. Everything has to be extremely well structured. And that's the nature of the beast, and that's good. But there is a trade-off between pragmatism, and it's a direction that we've taken actively at Factual, which is let's worry less about the structure around the data. And basically, we're developing, you know, flat files with attributes, and there are enough problems and solutions that can be solved with that approach that we're really focusing on that first. So I love the idea of linked data. Certainly, I think most folks in the room do. It's definitely a good thing. I would, from my own position, I'd say that, you know, before we start linking things together, let's articulate what things are.
You're sounding kind of like me there.
I hope that someone in the audience will ask where one can find a RoboCop on a unicorn image, because that's my question.
Hi, I just want to say I really enjoyed your talk. It's been really wonderful. My question is, I guess, mostly for Drew around, you know, with accounting, we require corporations to report a certain way and do that. Is there any sort of movement around asking them to provide JSON files? You know, like, is that the next wave of sort of accountability to say we need an engineer working with the accountant? You know, I'm just curious if there's any movement around that.
JSON, sadly, no. Okay. There's something called XBRL. Okay. It is a XML-based specification for releasing accounting information. If you go to the SEC's website, they have a whole section about it. I don't remember the exact dates, but at some time in 2009, I believe, they started a voluntary XBRL submission period, and that will end hopefully soon, and it will become mandatory that companies start submitting their annual and quarterly financials with, if not solely an XBRL, at least with an XBRL supplement for the details.
How compatible is that with JSON files?
Not at all.
Hi, I have a comment, a pretty open-ended question, and I need to apologize in advance because I'm very hungover this morning. The comment is that I saw a presentation by someone from the Pew Research Foundation a couple years ago, and they were talking about young people in social media, and the only thing that stuck out of the whole talk was when the speaker said, if there's one truth about young people, it's that they're very adept at finding places to operate in private. And so I just, you know, when we're talking about governments or corporations, it's analogous, I think. And the other one is, it occurs to me that the other thing that sort of seems similar is cartography, specifically map projections, which is, you know, which confuse the hell out of people. But every state has two or three, sometimes six, of their own map projections. The reason being that the world is not a perfect sphere. And at the end of each one of those latitudes and longitudes, like trying to figure out where they are on the planet, there's money, there's tax dollars associated with it, there's responsibility and authority. And then, you know, in the world of web mapping, Google Maps happened. And they simply decided to solve the problem by turning the world into a square. And you're like, well, too bad if you're in the holes. And you know, it makes cartographers apoplectic. They go, they can't believe that someone would do this, except that it's, you know, it's better than an 80-20 solution. It's pretty much like a 95-5 solution for stuff on the web. So that's the open-ended question. I just wonder if there's some analogous thing in terms of identifiers.
That is very much an open-ended question, Aaron. I look forward to hitting you back sometime with that. Thanks. I mean, geo is obviously, you know, a major issue. I couldn't articulate better than you did on the map projection comments, certainly. But one of the greatest difficulties that anyone has when working with how to get the correct content to the correct individual at the correct time is knowing where they are. And longitude and latitude is excellent because it's divorced from context. It's just two numbers, but of course it's also appalling because it's divorced from context. It tells us nothing about the place. I'll pass the mic over in a desperate attempt to Drew and Pete to see if they can comment on that.
At Sunlight, we have done quite a bit of work trying to sort of focus on the people who would like to hide a lot of their activities. We released an analysis called the 1% of the 1%, which shows the 1% of the 1% of campaign donors and showed sort of the disproportionate effect that they have on their money has on policy. And we also have done quite a bit of analysis in looking at the influence that the finance industry has. It's a common acronym is FIRE, the finance, insurance, and real estate. They have a large and very fast-growing influence in campaign finance, and that's all empowered by disclosure. And so your point about people being able to find ways to work in private, that's you know, all well and good for teenagers, but the world that we work in has to do with what people are legally obliged to do in order to carry out their activities.
Do we have other questions?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Two statements and then a question, and I do hate myself for having statements. I am a librarian, and I'm also a former consultant for Freebase, so those are my disclosures. So the question is, sometimes I watch folks create new organization systems, and as a librarian, I find this hilarious.
Yes.
Because librarians have already done it. So I'm wondering if you all work with librarians at all, or existing. Obviously, you're working with existing things, but I don't know about that.
So I am a librarian groupie. Just the fact that there's hundreds of years of experience of creating taxonomies and trying to categorize things, and just I'm kind of obsessed by the Dewey Decimal System. And part of what I've, you know, and that's part of where I'm coming from in my love of kind of like freeform text. Is like, you know, all of the classification systems that have been used to sort of, you know, put books on shelves or however you want to organize stuff, that they only ever capture sort of like a slice or a part of what's important about that thing. So that's why I want to have like kind of the human description there as well, because that's usually the most complete. And, you know, like with the company numbers, I would love to have like both a company number and the name of the company that the person entering the form thinks it is, so that if they screw up the number, at least you've got some kind of fallback.
Right, there's an opportunity for validation then.
Yeah.
So George was supposed to be on our panel, George Oates, and I'm very disappointed she wasn't here because that speaks, you know, basically this is a novel problem. It's something we've all been wrestling with. I mean, you've got the problem with like ISBNs, great, sometimes they're reused, dates from the 1970s. But everybody still uses their own identifiers. My answer, such as it is slightly orthogonal to your question, which is that some people ask us, well, can you do SEC codes and various other typing for your database at Factual of your 60 million businesses? Basically, the government has a certain type of cataloging system where basically you categorize these businesses. But the way the government does it is that the government types these businesses for the purposes of reporting on small business success in various sectors. And that's going to be totally different from, say, a Yellow Pages classification system, which is designed to sell ads, which is going to be extremely different from any kind of social location or social mobile app categorization system, where basically you just want to get your users to the kind of business that they're looking for, usually going to be use case driven. It's kind of a more of a focus on so-called social categories rather than professional service categories. So that's the long way of saying that I think classification systems, in the same way as identification systems, as Drew was pointing out, have different purposes. And very often, if you attempt to repurpose one for a different use case, you'll often end up several steps back than the destination that you intended to be in. We're wrapping up now. I just wanted to close with two final questions to my fellow panelists. We've talked a lot about entities, identifiers, disambiguation, et cetera. One thing that is sort of the cousin to this discussion is the idea of accessibility. So we all want to get information. We want to be clear what that information is. We haven't talked about how to make this accessible in terms of file formats and downloads, talking about the horrific abilities of structuring content with XML versus the glorious simplicity of JSON. Can you each give a very short 50, maybe 140 character comment on the role of accessibility in entities and information access?
Open source your code, please. Whenever you do any of these like conversions, just try and put whatever you've got in your toolkit out there if you possibly can. I've got Data Science Toolkit is my personal open source toolkit with a bunch of the stuff I've talked about.
Good. Drew?
140 characters or less. Everything Pete said plus CSV used properly.
I like it. Yes. Will you please join me in thanking my fellow panelists, Drew and Pete?